friends, welcome to episode 6 of Tim's Travails. Tim is an amazing IP attorney and the author of these wonderful books, The China Factor, The China Connection, and so many more. Today we are talking with one of his legal friends, law professor Mark Traphagen, the U.S. contributing author to the Legal Tristies Copyright Throughout the World. And that is quite the volumes, many volumes. So before they launch into their topic today, which is very important, very timely, artificial intelligence and its impact on labor, with a focus on how AI impacts the creative entertainment industries, including several recent developments that they'll talk about today. But let me tell you about Mark quickly. He is, in addition to being this amazing author, he has taught international and comparative intellectual property law at George Washington University Law School and the Munich Intellectual Property Law Center. After starting his legal career with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, he represented what is now the Software and Information Industry Association in negotiations with the WIPO Copyright Treaty and congressional enactment of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So clearly, Mark, you are well positioned to talk about this really timely topic. So I'm going to kick it over to Tim. Thank you both for being here on Tim's Travails.
Well, thank you, Hope. And Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation, Tim. I've been looking forward to this.
So we've decided on a topic that is so extremely broad, wide, and complex, and we're going to just barely be able to touch the, not maybe barely touch the surface, given how much is involved here. So, but before we get into that, I just noticed that yesterday we now have officially a new head of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, who was confirmed into the position, even though nominated in March, and finally goes on the job more officially, I guess, today, now that he's been confirmed. So anyway, just an aside, since we've both worked in the agency, so it'll be interesting to see how things go there.
Well, and at least according to a federal district court in Washington, D.C., we have the return of the Register of Copyrights.
Oh, well, I didn't see that one.
Yes, yes.
So someone, a friend of both.
Yes, at least until the case proceeds further.
Oh well, that's a good development for her anyway. We'll see how that plays itself out over the next few months or whatever as things go. But anyway, today we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. You are much more into this than I am these days. So in general, I mean, if there's a way, I don't know if there is an easy way to say what is artificial intelligence in the context that we're going to talk about today. And maybe I'll let you kind of, I don't know, describe that for us all.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, just from a conceptual general point of view, I mean, artificial intelligence is a information technology system. And as it's currently used, it comes in two flavors. One is non-generative, meaning you can think of artificial intelligence as a really supercharged search engine, you know, that is able to take existing content, source through it, and summarize it in response to a request. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's the kind of AI system that was at stake in a case that's currently on appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, which is the Thomson Reuters versus Ross intelligence case. Now, the other form of artificial intelligence is newer, and it's exemplified by chatbots like ChatGPT and Claude and other chatbots. That's generative artificial intelligence. Generative artificial intelligence actually intends to produce output that is at least novel in response to the prompts by the user. So you may not have just a search engine operating, but you'll have a query that is actually responded to. One way to think of generative AI is that it's in the prediction business. Based on an analysis during its training, vast amounts of textual and image data, it's able to take a look at the prompt by the user, associate that with concepts or that have it has been exposed to repeatedly, and then make predictions about which word should come after the first word in its response. Right? So there isn't a person there. There isn't a, you know, there isn't a Robbie the robot, some sort of artificial sentience. There is a very sophisticated, you know, prediction machine that has also been influenced by programmers to sort of favor certain predictions based on a technique called weighting. That is not waiting as waiting for a train, but weighting as in giving more emphasis to a particular part of a query and a particular part of the training that resulted in the language model.
So if I can, just out of curiosity, if maybe this is wrong, but in order to have the generative AI, this is why there's so much data necessary to train this thing to do it by itself.
That's correct. You know, it's it would be a mistake to think that these AI systems actually have literal copies of the data they've been trained on within their systems. But they have been exposed so much that they are able to make certain probabilistic predictions about which words should appear after others. And this came about somewhat by surprise because in the long history of stops and starts in AI development, you know, in the past, the approach was based on what were called expert systems, sort of putting together systems that were hierarchically arranged, you know, sort of like an index or a topical outline, and using that for the system to make inferences. However, just about the time that video game hardware was getting really sophisticated and that NVIDIA was making graphic processing units that were able to handle really high-powered video output, some enterprising researchers discovered that those chips from NVIDIA were able to handle so much data that they'd be useful in experiments to see, well, what happens if instead of trying to actually design an AI model, if we just used brute computing force to take a look at a vast amount of data, and then perhaps with a little bit of nudging, the system would begin to make its own inferences rather than ones that are provided by the system designers.
Yeah.
That, in fact, is what's happened, and that is, in fact, why NVIDIA is like the most highly valued company on the planet right now. You know, so we can actually attribute some of the credit or some of the blame for artificial intelligence and generative AI to the video game industry because there was demand for graphic processing units.
Yeah. So, and this, all of this generative AI, which requires all this data for the machine itself to do the predicting, requires a lot of data. Now, this is where things get interesting.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the amount of computing power is needed, first of all, in training a model. And then it's also very important in actually creating a system that will respond to input or queries from users. So let me break it down. There's sort of within an AI system such as ChatGPT or Claude or you know, any of the others, what users see is the user interface of an AI system. Okay. Now, an AI system has at least a couple of components conceptually. One is that there is the sort of like the chat part, you know, which interacts with the user and responds to the query and produces that query.
Yeah.
But behind that is what's really powering the system, which is that it is a model, a foundational model of either images that have been associated with particular labels in text, or a model which is based on exposure to vast amounts of text and has learned, well, not really learned, but it, there are certain inferences that the system now recognizes.
Right.
Between, you know, between words and their word order. So, you know, a lot of what we've seen on the legal side so far, from, you know, in the copyright and intellectual property field where I work, is disputes about the use of copyrighted works as data to train the models.
Yeah.
You know,
and let's, you know, just to step back just a little bit. I mean, when we say the copyrighted material that it's using to teach itself.
Right.
That means a lot of books that already exist. And that means a lot of imagery, artwork, whatever it may be, that already exists. And here we could be talking about whether it's music, whether it's lyrics, whether it's a novel, poems, artwork that we have on the walls, or whatever it may be, imagery-wise.
Right.
So now, yeah, things that have already been created by somebody else getting thrown in for this data, for this machine to create whatever's next.
That's right. That's right. And that generally involves exposing a, yes, you know, a computer program to that data repeatedly. And then after that's done, going ahead and making adjustments. And probably the final step of the process, which is always ongoing, is that, and this occurs with respect to the part of the system that interfaces with human users, is that there are certain guardrails that are added to the interpretation of a query or the production of output.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we've heard, you know, a fair amount about that in recent days outside the field of intellectual property with respect to, you know, unfortunate stories about people perhaps, you know, taking their relationship or their use of AI systems, you know, a little too seriously and, you know, and hurting themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, now that we've got a little bit of a concept here of all the data, which is already in existence. And then we have the generative AI, which is now we've got something creating something new based upon all the data input.
Mm-hmm.
We have some conflicts.
Yeah, we do have some conflicts. You know, the, like I said, most of the legal issues so far have been less involved with the output and more involved with the process of training and a generative AI model. And there are examples of those, like, for example, do I have one here? On the image side, for example, a company like Stability AI uses a model which is called DALL-E. That's DALL hyphen E. With respect to, like, Meta's Claude AI system, it uses a language, large language model that's called Llama. You know, and if you happen to use Perplexity, which is a sort of popular, you know, general purpose, consumer oriented AI system, they have a foundational model called RAG. So we have all of these models that have been prepared through a process of gathering huge amounts of information. And, you know, from both non-copyrighted data as well as copyrighted works that are available on the internet. Those may be gathered by, in some cases, actually licensing with the owners of the copyrights.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing some of that now. I mean, for example, you know, the Amazon, which is developing its own language model, has a content licensing deal with the New York Times. You know, on the other hand, ChatGPT and Microsoft do not have a licensing agreement with the New York Times. And that's the subject of a lawsuit, a copyright infringement suit by the Times. So there can be licensed content that's being used to develop this huge pool of data. Also, there are indications from you know, sort of the evidence and affidavits in some of the pending cases, particularly with respect to Anthropic and Meta, that because there was such a rush to develop AI models to keep up with the competition, that there was there were at least some people in the companies who decided that, you know, seeking permission was an unnecessary hindrance. And so they went forward and in two ways can accumulate high quality information. One is using spiders and bot applications to just scrape websites that don't have any sort of technical protection, that don't have, that they're not behind paywalls. Okay? The second way, which, and this was the case in the, this was the case in the Anthropic lawsuit, was that the AI developers would go to actual pirate websites posting, posting for free or for a small charge, unauthorized copies of copyrighted works, including novels and memoirs and nonfiction books, and copy that data and put it into their general pool of data to train the AI.
So just to back up just a moment. Now, when we're talking about the Anthropic situation, we're talking about them going to other websites that have taken material without permission, uploaded it, and now Anthropic went to the websites that were already illegally uploading material, and then again, illegally using, without permission, other people's works.
That's right.
So what we've got is actually one on top of the other, all at taking material without the author's permission to use it in any way.
That's right.
Which is
very much like the Sega V Mafia case 30 years ago, where there was a website putting up unauthorized copies of video games, and then users were downloading them.
And nobody was paying for them. Right, exactly.
That's right. Nobody's paying for it.
So that the person that's creating the work, whether it's a company, whether it's an individual, doesn't matter. They're just having the stuff ripped off, and nobody's paying them any royalties for all the energy work that they've put into creating the work to begin with.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And then once this, you know, this training process involves accumulating this vast pool of data, and then that data needs to go through a process to make it suitable for training a language model. So the data needs to be cleaned, meaning certain typographical errors, formatting issues, things like that removed. So there's a second copy made without authorization. Then that data needs to be tokenized, meaning that they're converted into a format that will be digestible by the incipient LLM. So that's the third copy, you know, and then fourth, some AI developers, for example, in Anthropic in this case, decided to keep a library, so made another copy of the cleaned, tokenized data that they had used to train the AI model. So it's pretty clear. Nobody has really questioned seriously that there's not an unauthorized reproduction taking place.
Right.
The question has been whether that reproduction is excused from liability, is excused from being considered infringement, because it may be fair use under the U.S. Copyright Act.
Yeah, which gets even more complicated for those who don't look at the copyright law itself about, you know, the line between fair use of a product or, you know, a work and infringement of that work. Because, you know, as the creator, yes, the law gives you this bundle of rights that you control. But the law also has a carve out for what we call fair use, and that can get complicated.
Yeah,
But
I mean,
in this
courts in the U.S. have recognized for over 100 years, and for the last 50 years have recognized in the Copyright Act expressly that there are situations in which there are certain public benefits to what otherwise would be called infringement. And that public benefit is related to the purpose of U.S. copyright law, which is to promote the progress of the arts and sciences. And so some uses may be considered on a case-by-case basis, generally to be permitted, even without authorization of the copyright owner. And, you know, usually those fall into areas such as like research, comment, criticism, parody, you know, things like that, where you have an, you know, sort of a use of the copyrighted work in order for the defendant, the person using it, to add something, make an expressive contribution. So, you know, one of the great examples was a Supreme Court case now 30 years ago in which, you know, the rock band, let me think of the name. Two Live Crew. I'm sorry. So Two Live Crew made a record using an old Roy Orbison song. Roy Orbison co-wrote, Pretty Woman. And Two Live Crew used the music, substituted their own lyrics. And whereas Roy Orbison sort of expresses his lyrics express longing and, you know, maybe a little too much longing by today's standards. But Two Live Crew was really criticizing a woman's appearance, that woman really wasn't pretty for the reasons listed. And Roy Orbison and his music publishing company sued Two Live Crew for unauthorized reproduction and adaptation of the original song. Those are both exclusive rights of copyright. The Supreme Court found, actually, the Supreme Court affirmed a lower court decision that said, no, this is parody. This is the type of activity that's excused by fair use. Fair use encompasses the First Amendment right to fair use. So that's why we don't have a separate First Amendment defense in copyright law, because it's already part of copyright law and fair use. And you know, the Supreme Court agreed with the lower court that, yeah, that's parody. You know, the original copyright owner may not like it, but it's permitted without any liability. You know? And there were there's multiple factors that are used by courts to determine this. Probably the most important, in most of the cases, and for people in general to keep in mind is, you know, what is the purpose of the unpermitted use? You know, why is the defendant, you know, using the copyrighted, work? You know, what's their purpose? Okay. And the second principal factor is, what is the effect of this use by the defendant on the valid commercial value or market for the copyrighted work that's being used? You know, and
So, and I think that when you look at this more recent case, Anthropic, when you find that they basically went out and grabbed illegally copied and obtained acquired works, and basically they're doing it as a business to generate income of some sort. And we're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of books. And of course, the proposed settlement was a pretty good sum of money, but we'll see how that all works out. But clearly, this doesn't neatly fall into the areas that allow for fair use because of the way in which they're running a business. So it's a little bit different.
I mean, look, there's when courts look at the purpose of the use, they are permitted to look at whether the use is commercial or non-commercial. You know, it's not determinative, but it's something they can use. And you know, in some cases that has made a difference. You know, for example, in February this year, the federal courts in Delaware decided the Thomson Reuters v. Ross International case, and they found that the use by the defendant of copyrighted summaries of cases and sample queries and responses that were loaded into a non-generative AI system, you know, without permission, was a commercial use because the defendant was going to go out and sell the system and compete with the copyright owner. So that court really gave a lot of weight to the fact that it was defendants were making a commercial use in order to find that there was not a fair use defense available to the defendant. Now that's on appeal. In contrast, you know, we see in the Bartz case and in the Kadri v. Meta case, both of which were decided in June of this year out in the Northern District of California, decided by two different judges on virtually the same day. They both reached the conclusion that the, that with the exception of copying by, like, from the pirate sites, that the use by the tech company defendants and making copies for training was a fair use because it was extremely transformative. And this is where there's been an interesting debate for the last 10 years because with respect to transformative, certainly, you know, a traditional understanding of transformative would be like the Two Live Crew case. Oh, you're taking something. You are adding original expression, right? You are adding this creative part, okay? And that's been, that's traditionally been recognized as that. In these cases, and a couple that have been given in the last 10 years, these technological cases don't involve so much an addition of expression. What they involve is a sort of conversion to a different purpose or a different technological means of using, you know, the copyrighted work. So, for example, the Google versus the Authors Guild, the federal courts, you know, Google had compiled from libraries, you know, they had compiled a lot of data in books that the libraries owned on their shelves, but those libraries didn't own the reproduction rights to make further copies. So, and Google used this to prepare a big database. Now, this is non-generative AI, but a big search engine attached to an even bigger database of all these books. And much as we might use Nexus or even a search engine like Google or DuckDuckGo, if you typed in a word, you would get, you know, sort of excerpts of various books as the response to the query. The federal courts in Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a finding that that was fair use, that that use by Google was transformative, even though they're not adding expressive content, but they are making the work available in a new way. Now, Google was saved in that case, I think, because they limited the responses to queries to excerpts, like about 25 words on each side of your search term. So in addition, it wasn't, the Google book system was not found to have a really big commercial impact on the value of the books that were copied. I think that, you know, here with respect to training AI, there's the, you know, there's the added anxiety of that these AI systems will have a commercial impact because, well, there is a concern, even a fear among creative artists and authors that the need for their work will be supplanted.
Oh, and that's maybe a good segue in causing a little bit of whiplash for those who are maybe listening, because of how much time we've spent on this side of things to talk about the labor impact, which is what you just hinted at.
Yeah, this is one of the things that, I see a lot of people in the creative arts, principally musicians and things, and authors. And I see, particularly among young people, a lot of difficulty in getting jobs. You know, among my kids who just, my younger daughter graduated from college last year. Now she's lucky to have a job, but she has friends who got computer science degrees. And, they're not getting jobs, notwithstanding that they got good degrees from good colleges and they're looking for work in dynamic big cities where there's supposed to be a lot of jobs. And that's, so the effect on employment of generative AI seems to have been felt first in the computer programming field, because generative AI seems to be even better at writing computer code than it is of responding to your query for an itinerary for your vacation at Disneyland this year. It's very good at writing code.
What you're saying is, the young people that might be entering university, the idea of going into computer science is going to be extremely different in the coming maybe few years than it has been in the past.
Yeah. And it seems to affect, I think the concern is that this will affect, sort of white collar professional and clerical workers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of across a wide range of incomes. And it's also going to affect, people in creative industries.
Sure.
Like advertising, film and motion pictures, music, and, video games.
Mm.
I have visited art schools that really specialize in preparing people for CGI film production and video game design and all of that. And there's a lot of concern on those campuses. And it's a bit borne out. I mean, I was looking at some recent figures, Tim, and studies. Now, this morning I was hearing a report on NPR of a study prepared by OpenAI that said, oh, there's going to be plenty of jobs that are going to be created by AI, okay, because, it'll open vast new fields of endeavor. I wouldn't expect anything different from that source, but we do have sources that are a little more dispassionate and detached, like the Dallas Federal Reserve, the Atlanta Federal Reserve, and the International Labor Organization. And they've done a pretty good job of sort of estimating fields in which there is exposure to displacement by AI, either a lot of tasks associated with the occupation will be sort of consolidated so that maybe fewer people in that occupational role are needed to do the work because AI helps out. Okay. In addition, there is exposure to one's occupational role being replaced.
Yeah.
Now, none of those studies can have been able so far to draw a documented link between the deployment of generative AI and what we're currently seeing, sort of the freezing of jobs. There may be other factors and so forth. The New York Fed also can't draw a documented link between them. But the New York Fed 2 weeks ago said that it predicts, that it expects that there will be significant displacement within the next several years, and that it will occur principally among people who have college educations. And once the robots come online, then the non-college educated professions, tend to be,
I think that this is bound to happen, right? I mean, the last 20 years or so, when we've seen like auto factories and such incorporating more robotics, and then here you were looking at and focusing on blue collar jobs.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now what we have is technology finally getting into that other space of white collar jobs. So that frankly, there are very few areas that won't be untouched by technology and how some jobs may be easier to replace with technology than in the past. And then that those fields become, they grow as far as those that are affected by technology, whether it's blue collar or white collar. So I think it takes, requires a lot of people in policy positions to start looking in the crystal ball 5, 10, 15 years out and saying, where are we going to be? And what kind of new things do we need to insert in the education process? And I, you know, it's a little EU education in the broadest sense, so that what we have is a population that can actually find jobs. Because I think, I mean, when I look back, you know, where I was going to college, there were a lot of people thinking they could get those well-paid blue-collar jobs that their fathers had and still live well, right? And within 10, 15 years, those jobs started to completely disappear. And even today, I mean, even if you have a car factory nearby, if you go inside of it, how many of those jobs or how many of those tasks have been taken over by robotics?
Right.
You don't need hundreds or thousands of people anymore when you can replace them with the robotics that can do things faster, quicker, and 24/7. You don't need three shifts, right, of people.
Right.
And now all of a sudden what we've got with AI is it's creeping into the white collar sector. So I think it requires a lot more long-term thinking about the impacts and maybe different types of people also being brought into the whole policy discussion, because maybe the kinds of people we've had in the past, we need to expand the field of people that we have talking about these things.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think, Tim, you know, on the, you know, with respect to blue collar and white collar, there is in the entertainment and creative industries, you know, there's that sort of, there is that sort of hybrid job model,
yeah,
which, you know, among production, post-production crews, things of freelancers, gig workers, that, you know, they're neither white collar nor blue collar, but in some cases they might be unionized, like, for example, the Writers Guild, SAG-AFTRA for performers who have concerns about deep fakes, animators who have a great deal of concern, and video game developers who, you know, will no longer be needed to like smooth out the texture. And a survey conducted in November and December of 2023, commissioned by the Animators Guild and some other entertainment labor groups, they surveyed 300 C-suite executives, senior executives, and mid-level managers in the entertainment industry, particularly in film and motion pictures, music and sound recordings, and in video games. And they were asked to estimate, well, first of all, they were asked three questions. One, have you deployed generative AI in your production process or in your business operations? The answer to both was yes. Second question, what percentage of jobs in your enterprise do you estimate will be displaced or eliminated?
Yeah. You
know? And and with respect to the creative side, film and video production, motion pictures said about the responses were about 22%. By 2026, we're almost there. So we can begin to count. And then third, what are the occupational roles that will be most affected? And there'll be the business side, you know, the folks in the office who are doing the budgets and overseeing production, and also the folks actually making the entertainment products. Mm. So they're going to be affected. And this was really a pretty, what was it? A film and TV animation by 2026, about a 22% effect. Music and sound recording has been slow to adopt generative AI, only about a 9% estimated effect by 2026. Video games, 15%. You know, and that's just by next year.
Yeah, that's just next year. So if all we do is go a few years out, even to 2030, we're talking about quite a bit more. So it's actually a trend that should be worrisome to a lot of people, because those are decent percentages in a very short period of time.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I don't have much insight into occupations outside of the entertainment field, other than law, a similar turmoil, because as in entertainment production, it's the entry-level jobs that are the most easily consolidated or replaced.
Yeah.
Because with generative AI, the job becomes second, you know, doing the second check of what the AI has produced.
Right. Which is not, it's not as substantive as what the generative AI is already doing. I mean, you're not needing it for that. You're simply needing it to just clean up and I'll call it editing, but in some ways it's just double checking some things here and there. It's, yeah.
It's well, it gets even worse than that, because you're not only checking for accuracy and for purpose,
right,
which is hard for both of those are a challenge for AI, you know, with respect to accuracy and checking, I like to think that, and on the prevalence of things that are being said on the internet, which, as we all know, there's a lot of unsubstantiated and misguided information on the internet. So, I mean, I like to think that, you know, if there was generative AI, if there was a chat box when Galileo was in Italy, he could have asked, you know, does the Earth go around the sun? And the answer from ChatGPT would be no. Because all the information that would have been available to it at that time, been information that indicates it doesn't. It would have been a lot of Aristotle and Ptolemy and, you know, and perhaps not as much Copernicus. So there's a limit on, you know, the accuracy of AI. And I think that editing is different than producing.
Yeah.
And, you know, to use an auto assembly, example, I mean, checking how tight the robot has screwed the nuts onto the bolt is a different job than actually assembling the parts.
Yeah.
And I think the jury is still out on which is the less interesting and more difficult job.
Well, that may be a good place to stop, because we've been, and you know, I think what we've done is highlighted just how complicated this whole thing is, because we've talked about it, the tiniest little bit of this, and there's certainly, we're still at the beginning of all of this, which means it's going to become even more complex. The boundaries will change, and of course, we've got a court system that's going to be scratching its head about how to basically go get through all of this and, you know, figure out who owns what and who's allowed to benefit financially or otherwise from all of this, because clearly that's what's going to cause a lot of cases to get to court, which is the financial interests of the various parties involved and all the data, who owns the data, how can it be used, and so on and so forth. So I think we're still at the very, very beginning. It's going to be interesting. I think I'm a little happy I'm not as much involved in the whole day-to-day legal work, given what's going on, because I think I'd probably be pulling out my hair, even though it's falling out by itself anyway. But a little bit, it could cause a bit of craziness to go on.
It is sometimes difficult to see the sunshine for the clouds.
Well, I went through the PowerPoint slides that you provided and read through them, and I thought, well, you know, if you look, as you did, just looking at the United States, what's going on here, what's going on in the European Union and their laws, and then China, this is going to be a bit of a complex and nightmarish scenario as court systems in each jurisdiction try to tackle this, and everybody who wants to be player. And when I say player, I mean whether you're the creator, whether you're the court system, the legal representation. Everybody's going to have to figure this out, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap.
No, but I do think, Tim, that on the geopolitical level, there's a lot of concerns about national security and defense.
Yeah.
I think those issues are separable
from
the issues of intellectual property and labor and all of that. So I think that the national security issues, while important, are a red herring with respect to how do we resolve these issues that are closer to home.
Yeah.
We've separated issues like that with respect to nuclear power, right? Oh, the bombs are over here. The reactors are here. We can do this with AI, and we shouldn't be influenced by scare tactics about national security.
Yeah, no, this is true. We'll see we'll just have to wait and see how it all plays out, but it's going to be a while.
We will. Thanks for inviting me to have this conversation.
It's interesting discussion, and there's just so much more that could be talked about, but we don't have all the time in the world to do that. But thank you, Mark, for being on today, and appreciate the conversation discussion.
Yes, thank you both. That was amazing, and it was frightening and enlightening. And I'm glad that we have smart people like you both talking about this. I, as a journalist, and my ex-husband as an illustrator, my daughter is a videographer, my son is an architect. This is really horrifying to us, the pictures of what it's all gone. And so many things are like that in the world right now. So this is just one more thing to be concerned about. But thank you, audience members, and thank you, Tim, who I love that you're interviewing attorneys. So it really brings to light how interesting the legal field is and complex and multifaceted. So thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mark. And again, we are talking today with GW law professor Mark Traphagen, the U.S. contributing author to the Legal Trustees Copyright Throughout the World. Check it out. Check out our liner notes so you can connect with Mark on LinkedIn and also buy his book. So thank you all. We'll talk to you for episode 7 of Tim's Travails. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. Have a great month. We'll talk to you soon.